Welcome to another deep dive with us. Today, we are going all the way back to colonial America
right.
to explore a really fascinating religious landscape of that era.
Okay.
And specifically, the emergence of the first Great Awakening.
Yeah.
And we've got this really interesting lecture here on American Christianity as our sort of guide.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that jumped out at me right away from the source material.
Okay.
Was a question that felt like it was kind of right at the heart of understanding the big shifts of that time period.
Yeah.
And maybe even, you know, shifts that we see in other contexts too.
Right.
Which is, why did those early churches, you know, the ones established with so much passion and conviction by the initial like waves of immigrants coming over.
Right.
Why did they seem to kind of lose a bit of that intensity?
Yeah.
You know, as time went on, as new generations came into the fold.
Mm.
So that's kind of the puzzle that I think we want to dig into first.
Well, that's a great place to start. Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting when you look at the history of any sort of movement, whether it's religious or political or even artistic.
Yeah.
You see this pattern where there's this initial burst of energy.
Yeah.
And this real strong conviction. And then the question becomes, okay, what happens next?
Yeah.
You know, how does that evolve over time? And so the lecture you shared really does a nice job of unpacking some of the key factors that contributed to this, specifically in the case of, you know, colonial churches.
So the first factor points to is maybe the most straightforward.
Okay.
And that's just a decline in that initial, like, fervor among the later generations.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a natural progression in a way, right?
Absolutely.
It's hard to maintain that same level of, like, revolutionary zeal across, you know, multiple generations.
Right. Like, it's hard to sustain that initial energy.
It makes me think about, you know, any field where you see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of the initial, like, revolutionaries
who
come in and then...
And they're so driven, right?
Yeah. And then things become a little bit more routine.
And I think it's especially true when you're talking about something like the lived experience of those early colonists.
Yeah.
You know, they were fleeing persecution or forging a new society. And that kind of intensity of experience isn't necessarily something that's directly shared by their children or grandchildren.
Right. It's like almost like a founding myth almost, you know?
Exactly. And so you can have a more, you know, conventional or routine participation in church life when you don't have that same kind of backdrop.
Okay. So then the lecture moves on to talking about disagreements within the churches themselves.
Okay.
And these weren't necessarily people leaving the denominations altogether.
Right.
But serious differences in terms of how they interpreted theological issues and, and how the church should be governed, basically. What's often called church polity.
Right, right.
And that sounds like it would create some serious tension.
It certainly did. And it's really interesting because you have these communities that came together in many cases seeking religious freedom. Right. They wanted to get away from, you know, what they saw as persecution or, you know, a lack of freedom to practice their faith. And yet, even within those relatively tight knit communities, you start to see variations emerge in terms of how they understood scripture, how they thought congregations should operate. Mm. And that's, I think, almost inevitable when you have, you know, a group of people trying to maintain absolute unity of belief and practice over time. It's just...
It's hard. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a natural kind of a process of...
As groups grow and change.
Right.
Okay, so that kind of leads us nicely into the third reason the lecture points to.
Okay.
Which is this much wider intellectual shift
mm-hmm.
happening during the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment.
Right.
Where rational thought really started to come to the forefront.
Yeah.
And the lecture specifically mentions the rise of deism.
Okay.
Now, for folks who might not be totally familiar with that term, how would you kind of explain deism in simple terms?
Sure. Yeah. So deism is essentially the belief that God created the universe, set up these natural laws that govern it, and then kind of stepped back.
Okay.
So it's like a clockmaker who builds this intricate clock.
Right.
And then lets it run on its own.
Okay.
So God's not really directly involved in day-to-day life.
Okay, so like not intervening.
Not intervening, not answering prayers.
Right.
Not performing miracles.
Okay.
It's a much more kind of distant concept of God.
Okay, so that's quite different from the traditional Christian view.
Very different, yeah. Because in traditional Christianity, you have a God who's actively involved in the world.
Yeah.
Involved in individual lives.
Right, personally involved.
Personally involved, yeah.
Okay, so that's a pretty big challenge to the established churches.
It was a huge challenge because it presented this alternative that was based on reason, based on observation of the natural world.
Yeah.
And it really challenged you know, the authority and doctrines of the churches.
Yeah, so it's not just an abstract debate. Right, this is like actually influencing how people are
exactly
seeing the world.
And the lecture points out this fourth factor, yes, which is that you had colonies like Rhode Island and Pennsylvania,
okay,
that had increased religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually led to a rise in people openly identifying as atheists or agnostics.
Oh, wow.
And even, you know, expressing antagonism toward organized religion.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a pretty big shift.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty new thing in the American context at the time.
It was very new, especially because, you know, if you look at Europe,
right,
most of the big religious conflicts had been internal.
Right, between denominations.
Between different types of Christians fighting with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you see in America is this new element of people who are saying, you know, I don't believe in any of this.
Right.
Or I'm skeptical of all organized religion.
Right.
And that's really a product of that greater freedom of conscience.
That's really interesting.
That some of these colonies championed.
Okay, so we've got this picture emerging of these once, you know, vibrant immigrant churches,
mm-hmm,
now facing this kind of confluence of challenges.
Yeah.
Right. A decline in internal enthusiasm.
Right.
All these disagreements about, you know, doctrine and governance.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectual challenges from the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And now this growing external skepticism.
Right.
Really sets the stage for something new to happen.
Absolutely.
But before we get to that, the lecture gives this fascinating little snapshot,
okay,
of just how religiously diverse the colonies were,
mm-hmm,
and how geographically concentrated certain denominations were.
Yeah. And it really shows you how regional variations in religious life were.
Okay.
So, for example, Congregationalism, as the lecture highlights, was primarily concentrated in New England.
Okay.
Which makes sense given its Puritan roots.
Right.
And the initial settlement patterns of that region.
Oh, right. The Pilgrims and all that.
Exactly.
Okay. And then you've got the Anglican Church, which would later become the Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more widespread.
It was, yeah.
Throughout the colonies.
All over.
Even down in Georgia.
Even in Georgia, yeah.
With Virginia being kind of a stronghold.
Right. A real center of Anglicanism.
It's interesting to note, too, its early connections to John Wesley.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So while the Methodist movement that Wesley founded came a bit later,
yeah,
his early experiences as an Anglican missionary in the colonies were really foundational.
Interesting.
Yeah, you can see those seeds being planted.
Okay. And then there's Presbyterianism.
Right.
Which the lecture mentions was smaller in number.
Smaller overall.
Yeah. But also pretty dispersed.
Yeah, spread out.
Without like one single dominant center during this time period.
Exactly. Not like a central hub at this, yeah, point.
And then the Baptists.
Ah, the yes, they were all over the place.
Yeah, it seems like they were the real like pioneers.
Yeah, they were in almost every colony.
Yeah.
With a particular stronghold in Rhode Island.
Right, which makes sense.
Which makes perfect sense given Roger Williams and his advocacy for religious liberty there.
Right. Rhode Island was like the place to go.
It was a haven.
If you were, you know, outside the mainstream.
Exactly. A place where you could find freedom of conscience.
Yeah.
And then you have the Roman Catholics.
Okay.
Now, they were a relatively small minority at this point.
Okay.
Concentrated mainly in the middle colonies.
Okay.
Places like New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland.
Okay.
And it's a good reminder that, you know, the later waves of Catholic immigration to places like Boston,
right,
hadn't happened yet.
It's easy to forget that.
It's easy to forget that, yeah, our modern perceptions of, you know, early America,
yeah,
can sometimes be a little bit skewed by what happened later.
Totally.
And then we've got the Quakers or the Friends.
Okay.
And they were also pretty geographically spread.
Yeah.
Finding communities both in New England and in the middle colonies,
mm-hmm,
especially in those havens of tolerance like Rhode Island and Pennsylvania.
Right.
Places that were really open to different beliefs.
Yeah.
The lecture also points out the Lutheran presence primarily in the middle colonies.
Okay.
With Pennsylvania, again, being a key area.
Right.
Because of its welcoming policies towards German immigrants.
Okay.
Many of whom were Lutheran.
Got it.
And finally, the Dutch Reformed Church.
Okay.
Largely concentrated in the middle colonies, especially New York and New Jersey.
Gotcha.
And it's interesting to note that the first Great Awakening actually had some of its early sparks within this community.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you see these stirrings of revival,
okay,
even before it kind of explodes onto the scene.
Wow. So it's really like this patchwork.
It's tapestry, yeah.
Of different beliefs and practices.
A real mix.
Okay. So we've got this backdrop of both declining fervor in some areas,
right,
and this incredible religious diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's against this backdrop that we encounter our main figure for this deep dive.
Okay.
Jonathan Edwards.
Yeah, this pivotal figure.
The lecture really establishes him as a transformative individual.
He absolutely was. And the lecture identifies him as one of the most important American-born theologians and philosophers.
Okay.
And his life, which spanned from 1703 to 1758, although, you know, not exceptionally long,
right,
had this immense impact on the course of American religious history.
And just to give folks a little context, he was born in East Windsor, Connecticut.
That's right. A real local connection to the American experience.
Yeah, born and bred.
Absolutely.
It's kind of astonishing to hear about his early intellectual gifts.
Yes, remarkable.
Fluent in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew by the age of 13.
I mean, that's just mind-blowing.
Hard to even imagine.
It speaks to a truly exceptional mind from a very young age.
Yeah.
And it's not just languages.
Right.
The lecture also talks about his deep interest in the natural sciences.
Okay.
And this wasn't just a separate academic pursuit.
Yeah.
It really shaped his ability to observe and analyze.
Okay.
Skills that he then applied to his theological and philosophical inquiries.
Yeah.
He saw the natural world as this testament to God's intricate design.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah, a reflection of God's wisdom and power.
And speaking of his intellectual journey, it led him to Yale.
Yeah.
At an incredibly young age.
Not even 13 years old.
Can you imagine?
It's hard to fathom.
Going to college at that age?
It's just extraordinary. And the lecture gives us this glimpse of what Yale would have been like back then.
Right.
So different from the sprawling university we know today.
Right.
It was basically a church and a few nearby buildings.
Yeah.
And initially it was located in Wethersfield, Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So even Yale has moved.
Even Yale has moved.
Over the years.
Wow. So that Wethersfield church sounds like a pretty significant spot.
It's a real tangible link to that early period of American history.
Yeah.
And especially with its connection to Edwards.
And as the lecture goes on to say, throughout his time at Yale and beyond, Edwards was really a staunch defender of traditional Calvinistic and Puritan theology.
Absolutely. He believed that it offered the most accurate interpretation of the Bible. And he wasn't afraid to engage with and argue against other perspectives.
Like what kind of perspective?
Well, for example, the growing popularity of Arminian theology,
okay,
which emphasized individual free will in salvation.
Okay, so kind of a different view of how salvation works.
A very different view.
Yeah.
And he also argued against deism.
Right, which we talked about earlier.
Which we talked about, yeah, which denied the divine nature of Jesus.
So he's kind of standing against the tide a little bit here.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, the intellectual currents of his time were moving in a different direction, but he held firm to his convictions.
And the lecture mentions that Calvinist Puritan theology had actually seen a decline by the time Edwards came on the scene.
It had lost some of its, you know, cultural dominance.
Okay.
It wasn't as vibrant as it had been in the previous century.
And so his role in bringing it back through the First Great Awakening is a really central part of his legacy.
Absolutely. I mean, he's seen as this key figure who revitalized this tradition.
Okay, so let's talk about his own personal journey now.
All right.
His conversion and the beginning of his influential ministry.
Yeah.
The lecture really highlights his personal narrative as this key text.
It's a foundational text, yeah, for anyone who wants to understand Edwards.
Yeah.
His inner life, his theological development.
Okay.
And this conversion experience that he describes.
Okay.
Which happened on January 12, 1723.
Okay.
It was a pivotal moment for him.
Okay.
He describes it as this complete and solemn dedication of himself to God.
Wow.
This moment where he surrendered his will to God's will.
Okay.
And it really set the course for everything that followed.
So after that, he moves to Northampton, Massachusetts.
That's right, in 1727.
Okay.
To assist his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard.
Right.
Another important figure in early American religious history.
Oh, okay. So like a family legacy?
Yeah, there's this lineage there.
Wow.
And Stoddard was a prominent minister in Northampton.
Okay.
And then when Stoddard passed away in 1729, Edwards took over the pastoral responsibilities.
Okay, so that's a big moment of transition.
A real passing of the torch.
Yeah.
And it's also worth mentioning that he got married during this time.
Oh, okay.
So, to Sarah Pierpont.
Okay.
And they had a very large family.
How large?
11 children.
11 children. Wow.
Yeah. A bustling household.
That's a lot of kids.
It certainly is. And it's striking to hear about his incredibly disciplined study habits.
Okay.
He dedicated something like 13 hours a day to reading and writing.
Wow.
I mean, that's just an incredible level of commitment to intellectual pursuits.
You don't often hear about that kind of rigor.
No.
Especially fueling a revival.
Right, because you tend to think of revivals as being these very emotional, experiential things.
Right.
But for Edwards, it was rooted in this deep understanding of Scripture.
Okay.
This intellectual grasp of the truth.
Yeah.
And that's what gave his preaching its power.
It's a good reminder that, you know, being intellectual and being spiritual.
Absolutely.
Do I have to be at odds?
They can go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And the lecture also addresses the complex issue of Edwards owning slaves.
Right.
Which, you know, it's important to acknowledge.
Yeah.
Obviously a deeply problematic aspect of his life and something that we can't excuse.
Right.
But it's also important to understand it within the historical context of the time.
The norms of that era.
Yeah. Slavery was tragically widespread.
Yeah.
And so while the lecture notes that some biographers say he treated enslaved people with a degree of care, you know, even referring to them as employees, that doesn't in any way justify the institution of slavery itself.
Of course.
It's just a reminder that, you know, even individuals who champion significant spiritual and intellectual ideals can be caught up in the contradictions of their time.
Right.
Yeah, it's a complicated legacy.
It's a lot to wrestle with.
It is.
Okay, so then we get to his preaching style.
Okay.
Which the lecture kind of surprisingly describes as not being
overly
emotional or theatrical.
Yeah, not a fire and brimstone preacher.
No, not like a, you know, jumping up and down on the stage kind of thing.
No, more subdued.
Okay.
More methodical.
So what was it like?
The lecture says it was more like a lawyer.
Okay.
Carefully presenting a case.
Okay.
Building an argument based on biblical truth.
So like very rooted in the text.
Deeply rooted in Scripture.
Okay.
And yet remarkably, this style was incredibly effective.
Wow.
It's credited with sparking the first Great Awakening around 1734.
Wow. So it just goes to show that, you know, there's not one right way to preach or to connect with people.
And it's interesting to contrast him with a later figure like George Whitefield, who was like the exact opposite in terms of delivery.
Yeah.
Much more fiery, much more theatrical,
but
both were used powerfully by God during this period.
The different strokes for different folks.
Exactly.
The lecture also mentions Edwards' influential book, A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God.
Published in 1737.
Okay.
And this played a crucial role.
Okay.
In spreading the news of the awakening.
Okay.
Even reaching figures like John Wesley in England.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you see these transatlantic connections?
Yeah.
The world was a lot smaller than we sometimes think.
So it's really highlighting how interconnected things were.
Absolutely.
Even back then.
Ideas could travel.
Yeah.
And movements could gain traction across the ocean.
And the lecture emphasizes that it wasn't just, you know, the usual churchgoers.
Right.
Who were affected by this.
It wasn't just people who were already devout.
Yeah.
You had people from all walks of life.
Okay.
All different backgrounds.
Like who?
People who had been skeptical of religion.
Okay.
People who had been antagonistic towards it.
Wow.
They were experiencing conversion.
Interesting. So it really was this widespread phenomenon.
It was a powerful movement.
Okay. But this period of, you know, amazing revival and growth in Northampton led to some serious conflict.
It did.
For Edwards.
Yeah.
Particularly regarding something called the Halfway Covenant.
Right.
Can you remind us what that was all about?
Sure. So the Halfway Covenant, which had been developed back in the mid-17th century, was essentially a compromise that allowed for people who had been baptized as children, but hadn't necessarily had this, you know, personal conversion experience, to have their own children baptized.
Okay.
And become partial members of the church.
Partial members.
Yeah. So they weren't granted full communion rights.
Got it.
But they could participate in some aspects of church life.
Okay. And Edwards was not a fan.
No. Edwards was not a fan. He held to a much more rigorous view of church membership.
Right.
You know, he was a Puritan through and through. Mm. And he believed that baptism, and especially the Lord's Supper, should be reserved for those who could offer a clear profession of faith.
Okay, so like a real heartfelt conversion.
Exactly, a genuine experience of God's grace.
Oh.
And he saw the Halfway Covenant as lowering the bar, diluting the purity of the congregation.
Okay.
And this caused a lot of tension.
I got it.
Because the Halfway Covenant had become pretty dominant in New England Congregationalism by this point.
So even in Northampton?
Even Northampton, yeah.
Where he was pastoring.
It was the accepted practice.
And so this is what led to his dismissal.
It did in 1750.
Wow.
After many years of faithful ministry.
So he gets kicked out of his own church.
Essentially, yes.
Wow. That's got to be tough.
It was a very painful experience for him and his family.
Makes you think about the cost of sticking to your principles.
It does. Yeah. Sometimes doing what you believe is right can come at a high personal price.
But as we often see in these stories, what seems like a setback can lead to new opportunities.
Absolutely.
So he moves to Stockbridge, Massachusetts.
That's right. In 1751.
Okay.
And the lecture describes it as this kind of remote wilderness.
Really a missionary outpost.
Yeah. Far from the centers of power and influence.
And this period becomes really productive for him.
It does, in terms of his writing and theological reflection.
It's kind of counterintuitive, right?
It is. Yeah. You'd think that, you know, being removed from this prominent position would lead to a decline in output.
Right.
But for Edwards, it was the opposite.
So he had the space and time.
He had the space and time, the quiet to really dive deep into these theological questions.
And one of the most important things he produced during this time was his work on the freedom of the will.
A careful and strict inquiry into the modern prevailing notion of freedom of the will.
Okay.
Quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
But an incredibly important work.
And in it, he basically defends the doctrine of predestination.
Right.
Against this, you know, growing Arminian emphasis on free will.
Exactly.
So he's still engaged in these debates.
Yeah. He's still grappling with these core theological issues.
Even though he's kind of out in the wilderness.
Even though he's been pushed aside by the mainstream.
Wow. Okay. And then towards the end of his life, this really unexpected invitation comes along.
It does.
To become the president of Princeton University.
What a turn of events.
Right. In 1758.
Yeah. I mean, talk about vindication.
Right.
It's a real testament to his reputation, his influence.
It's interesting that the lecture says, we'll talk about the details of Princeton's founding later.
Right. We'll get to that.
But just this invitation alone.
Yeah.
Speaks volumes.
He really does.
But as we know, his time at Princeton was tragically brief.
It was.
The lecturer recounts how he moved there and then died from a smallpox inoculation.
Just a few months after taking on the presidency.
Wow.
A real reminder of the fragility of life.
Yeah.
And the lecture frames it as his acceptance of God's will.
Right.
Even in the face of such an untimely end.
A poignant end.
A poignant end to a remarkable life.
Yeah. So he's gone. But his influence is really just getting started.
That's right.
As the lecture goes on to detail, he had a lasting impact.
A profound legacy.
Yeah.
And one of the key results of his work and the first Great Awakening more broadly was a significant revival of Calvinistic theology in American religious and cultural life.
So he really did breathe new life.
He did.
Into that tradition.
He brought it back to the forefront.
The lecture also emphasizes his kind of remarkable balance.
Yeah.
Between, you know, intellectual rigor and deep spiritual devotion.
Right. He was a scholar.
Yeah.
But also a man of deep faith.
And not just a man of faith, but a man of action, too. Right?
Well, absolutely. He put his faith into practice.
Yeah.
He lived it out.
And this idea that the lecture brings up.
Yeah.
That all truth is God's truth.
That's a powerful concept.
Yeah. Encompassing all these different fields.
Science, theology, philosophy, ethics, even economics.
Wow.
He saw all of these as interconnected.
Wow.
Pointing back to God as the ultimate source of truth.
And the lecture also talks about the power of preaching directly from the scriptures.
Now, yeah. That was a hallmark of Edwards' ministry.
Yeah.
He didn't rely on gimmicks or tricks.
Well,
he just expounded the word of God.
And it clearly resonated with people.
It did.
Because it wasn't just, you know, his own congregation who were influenced by him.
It was a much wider circle.
Okay.
He had this remarkable intellectual and cultural succession.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
Well, the lecture points out that he had numerous clergymen.
Okay.
Presidents of higher learning professors who were his direct descendants.
Why?
His influence spread through generations.
Wow. That's incredible.
It's a real lineage of impact.
Yeah.
And then there are the Edward Edzazians.
Okay.
His direct theological followers, people like Joseph Bellamy, Samuel Hopkins, Jonathan Edwards Jr.
His own son.
His own son, carrying on the tradition.
Wow.
And it's interesting because while they largely carried on his framework, they also introduced some of their own nuances and shifts in emphasis. So, for example, some of them moved towards a greater emphasis on free will.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which, you know, Edwards himself had been pretty staunchly against.
Yeah.
And some even questioned certain aspects of original sin.
Wow.
So it shows you how intellectual and theological traditions evolve over time.
They're not static.
No, they're living things. They're constantly being reinterpreted and reapplied.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive into the religious landscape of colonial America.
Yeah.
And the really multifaceted impact of Jonathan Edwards.
Right.
We've explored so much.
Yeah.
The reasons for the decline of those early churches.
Yeah.
This really diverse religious map of the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And the legacy of this pivotal figure.
This towering figure.
Yeah.
In American religious history.
It really gives you a much deeper understanding.
I think so.
Of this crucial period.
Yeah.
In the development of American identity and thought.
And it brings up a really important question that I think is worth pondering. How do these tensions between tradition and change, reason and faith, individual freedom and communal belief, how do they continue to shape our understanding of these concepts today?
Yeah.
Because these are themes that are still very much alive in our world.
Yeah, they resonate even now, centuries later.
They do. It's a conversation that's ongoing. Host.